Everybody seems to have made it on this beautiful day in Chicago. First case is appeal number 08-1981, Cancer Foundation versus Shervis Capital. Mr. Blood.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court.
Counsel.
I represent 28 plaintiffs in this appeal from the dismissal of a civil RICO claim with prejudice. And our position is that this dismissal was premature. Naturally, the standard of review is de novo, naturally we're entitled to all inferences in our favor and to have the amended complaint construed in our favor. And, of course, in a dismissal based on the statute of limitations, as this one was, the question is when the plaintiff knew or should have known that he was injured by the defendant and that it was wrongful. And that is, I think, the issue in this appeal is not when the plaintiffs knew that they were injured, but when they knew that it was wrongful. On the statute of limitations, I think there's four essential points. The first one being that the Lapidus plaintiffs were aware that Winterland was financed by Cerberus and by Gordon Brothers. Mr. Lapidus and his companies naturally knew this. And because they knew this, they also knew that Cerberus and Gordon Brothers were entitled to act together, were privileged, if you will, to act in concert. That they had the right, Cerberus and GBCC had the right to cooperate. They had the right to consult. They had the right to act with respect to Winterland as a unit.
Let me ask you. All these events took place a long, long time ago, 97 or so. You make a point here about this Forbes article that apparently cast new light on the situation or something like that. I've read that. I don't see what in there would have caused a light bulb to go off and say, we've got a claim against these defendants that now assert, even though these events occurred 10 years before the complaint was filed.
Judge Evans, I'd like to share a startling revelation that I've had about that article, but I don't have one. I don't see anything in it either that other than in the barest, most general terms. And
but that's one of the things you're relying on here, isn't it?
Well, it is. It is. But the statute of limitations is also an affirmative defense. And the complaint did not have to plead its way around the statute of limitations. So the complaint should not stand or fall on whether that article was sufficient.
Well, Judge Lefkoe determined that you, in fact, pled yourself out of court by pleading facts that showed that the statute of limitations had long expired when this 2007 complaint was filed.
Yes. And at this point, I can't say that ultimately this case will not be disposed of because of the statute of limitations. I'm saying it's premature now that the plaintiffs did not have to plead why they discovered or why they came to believe that they had been wrongfully injured by these defendants.
Mr. Blood, with respect to the senior note holders, why can't we assume that NCB kept them adequately advised and therefore that they knew of their injury much earlier?
Judge Ripple, that's a possible inference, but it's not the most favorable inference to the plaintiffs. It's possible that they weren't advised. And in the context of an appeal from a dismissal, it suggests that we're entitled to the inference that they weren't advised. And this complaint does not tell to the contrary.
With respect to the Cancer Foundation, isn't their injury, as a matter of law, a derivative injury?
As the complaint stands, it may be. As the complaint stands, it very well may be.
Well, what facts possibly could be pleaded that would make it anything other than a derivative injury?
That I do not know, Your Honor. I can only share, I only know what was alleged. And beyond that, I'm in complete ignorance on that point.
While we're on that particular theme, there are alternate grounds for affirmance suggested. And as I understand it, your position is that you haven't had a chance really to join issue with respect to many of those. But one of them is whether there's been a failure to allege an enterprise. What could possibly be pleaded that would make this look like anything other than a closed-end fraudulent conspiracy and nothing else? It seems that's what you've got here. So far you've pleaded a closed-end fraudulent conspiracy, and I find it difficult to see how you could possibly amend to make it look like anything else.
Well, how could we say that there were others? How could we say that there was even one other? The Corum case that we discovered while researching would seem to answer that question. And, Your Honor,
and
I think...
How would it answer it, sir?
We know that in that case, if I'm reading this correctly, that that Cerberus settled a civil RICO claim, in that case, for $56 million. We would very much like to know, we would very much like discovery about that case. And it seems to me that with that opinion on the books, that we're entitled to, at least at this point, a free pass on that issue. That it's likely that those facts will be found, that the complaint can be amended, that the enterprise does exist. If someone thought highly enough of a claim that the enterprise did exist to pay $56 million on it, we'd just like to know why it was paid. Discovery would be invaluable, and I think it's a great deal better than a fishing expedition at this point.
After TransColor went into bankruptcy, how could the senior note holders not know they'd been injured?
I think the question there is by who, Your Honor, that they knew they'd been injured by TransColor. They knew they'd been injured by Olico. But what about these defendants? I don't see how, without more, they would make the connection with these defendants. It's certainly not in the complaint if there's some connection there. I don't see it.
Thank you.
What troubled me, and I expect it would trouble this court, is if I'm standing up here and telling you that the plaintiffs, the Lapidus plaintiffs, did not know that the injury due to the actions of Cerberus and Gordon Brothers was wrongful, then why did Winterland sue the sue GBCC? Why did TransColor, rather, sue Cerberus and Gordon Brothers in 1999? I mean, if they didn't know it was wrongful, why did they sue? That troubled me greatly in this case until I looked past the fact that suit had been filed in that case and looked at what had been said in the opinion in that case. And what struck me is that after stating the facts, the TransColor court immediately immediately said, under conclusions of law, it's the first thing there, it said, in essence, Transcolor does not have a cause of action here. Does not have a cause of action. If you don't have wrong, you don't have a cause of action. And that's, in essence, what the Transcolor Court held, that Transcolor could not sue for, could not sue entities that put Winterland into bankruptcy. There's no cause of action for that. It's not wrongful. It's not wrongful to counsel a company to go into bankruptcy. It's not wrongful to force a company into bankruptcy. And why the 1990 suit was filed, I have no idea. Yes, they knew they'd been injured. Yes, they knew it was the acts of Cerberus and Gordon Brothers et al. But wrong? Where was the wrong? There was no wrong. Why was that suit filed? I have no idea. It troubled me initially, but after reading the opinion, I don't have any trouble explaining it away.
What, if anything, are we to make of the fact that the original plaintiff's attorney withdrew from this case during the 21-day safe harbor time in light of the Rule 11 sanctions motion? Should we take that into account in any way or draw any inferences from that?
I infer that he ran off before he gave his clients a fair shot. I infer that he was yellow.
Okay. Fair enough.
I think same thing of substitute counsel. I mean,
you're the third.
I am the third. I had nothing to do with this case until after the notice of appeal was filed. But that there's more here, this is a good faith claim. There is no reason not to bring it. I'd like to share a revelation that I had on that subject. The complaint and the amended complaint both state that MML Inc. sued Campbell, the CFO of Winterland. That's not true. It's just not true. I think if counsel had stayed around long enough to get his facts right, and we explained this in our reply brief, that counsel was run off before counsel understood the facts. And he was under heavy pressure. I mean, very first thing that happened when he filed, the very first filing by the defendants in the complaint, in the case, was for sanctions. The defendants consistently operated on this as a sanctions case, and there's a lot of facts in this case, and I think that counsel preceding me was under the gun all the way and basically not willing to take it to a fight. I would like to spare some time for a rebuttal if the court has no further questions. Thank you.
Hey, Mr. Farden.
Thank you, Your Honor. Zachary Farden on behalf of the appellees. Your Honor, just to pick up on the question about counsel below and the circumstances of the Forbes article as well. I respectfully disagree with Mr. Blood's sort of inference that counsel was yellow. Your Honor, we laid out in some detail in the Rule 11 salvo, which was a safe harbor salvo, which is to say we didn't file it. We simply sent a letter laying out our concerns on the statute of limitations issue, which were facially obvious based upon the complaint. And in the wake of that, the initial change to the amended complaint was to add this reference to the Forbes article, which importantly, and as Judge Lefkoe pointed out, Your Honors, did not say what the amended complaint purported that it said. The amended complaint suggested that the Forbes article said that this gentleman, Marty Whitman, who was associated with Third Avenue Value Fund, had been looking 9 years earlier, so in 1997, to take over small cap companies, when in fact all the article says is that he had an associate who had urged him to get involved or to start a small cap fund. Two very different things, and Judge Lefkoe below in her opinion used the word disingenuous in connection with the reliance upon that article, and I would respectfully submit she was being judicious in her word choice there. So I think the reason for the withdrawals in this case is simply that these facts, that the amended complaint, original complaint and amended complaint, pleaded sufficient facts to where they did plead themselves out of court, and there was no non-frivolous basis for proceeding. Clearly, the statute of limitations in this case had lapsed, and counsel recognized that and withdrew and told the court, sought permission to withdraw, told the court as much, told the court that there was a difference of opinion with the client, and the client nonetheless has chosen to proceed, and here we are. I want to make sure I address any questions the court may have, but I do want to return to something Mr. Blood said, or I think I understood him to say, that he doesn't dispute that this case may not survive on statute of limitations grounds. And so the sole issue, as I hear him speaking, being presented, is whether, in fact, this has been pled out of court. And, Your Honor, as Judge Lefkoe clearly went through in some meticulous detail in her opinion below, this amended complaint was extremely... I apologize, Your Honor.
Did you say that she went through it in ridiculous detail?
No, I did not. I think I said significant detail, Your Honor.
I thought you said meticulous.
I'm sorry. Well, perhaps
whatever,
I said meticulous.
Whatever you said.
Meticulous, ridiculous.
I certainly...
Tomato.
No, Your Honor, and I'm sorry if I'm not speaking clearly enough, but she went through it in some detail. I mean, this is not a cursory opinion. This is an 18-page opinion where she explained all of these transactions based on the amended complaint and how and why these plaintiffs had pled themselves out of court. And I do want to point out that if you just focus on the four corners of the amended complaint, each of these things in the sequence, including the 1997 complaint that Your Honors were asking about, in which this conspiracy theory initially was brought by Winterland against Carl Campbell, the former CFO, that's described in the amended complaint. The bankruptcy of Winterland that made TransColor insolvent and thereby caused this remote injury, allegedly, to the note holders in August of 1997, that's in the amended complaint. NCB, the trustee that Your Honor was asking about for these note holders, brought a default judgment claim against Aleco and TransColor in early 1998, after which NCB caused TransColor to be placed in bankruptcy in 1998. That is described in the amended complaint.
Now, Mr. Blood, as I understand it, doesn't believe we can make the inference that because NCB was involved in those activities that necessarily the senior note holders were adequately apprised of their injury. Could you speak directly to that?
Yes, two things on that point. One is that the trustee, and we make this point in our papers, had a statutory obligation to keep those note holders informed. And in addition to that, I think the court can fairly infer that this trustee was not a negligent trustee. They did their job. They forced TransColor into bankruptcy. They brought suit against Mr. Lapidus and Aleco and TransColor, ultimately prevailed on behalf of the note holders in that lawsuit, which is, again, something described in our papers. The other thing, though, I would say on that, Your Honor, is you don't even have to get there. The question is whether these note holders should have discovered their injury had they been diligent. And we've cited cases in our papers, including the Duke case and the Fayod case, that stand for the proposition that when a plaintiff learns they have been injured, they have an obligation to try to determine who caused that injury. And in this case, whether or not the trustee met their statutory obligations to notify these folks, they held these notes. They held them over a number of years. The notes were attached on a string to the financial fortunes of Morton Lapidus and ultimately, through this supplemental indenture, to TransColor. As the court has pointed out, TransColor was placed in bankruptcy in 1999. In the wake of that, TransColor sued these very appellees, these very defendants, saying that they were responsible for TransColor being placed in bankruptcy. And then NCB brought its own suit. The Maryland court in that suit issued opinion in June 2003, still outside the statute of limitations, setting forth all of those things I just described, including the fact that TransColor had sued these appellees on the theory that they were responsible for forcing TransColor into bankruptcy. All of that, Your Honor, in the four corners of this amended complaint, and I think the court can fairly infer that the note holders, with any diligence whatsoever, would have been aware of these theories or these ostensible claims.
I invite your attention for a moment to the Cancer Foundation. I know there's an issue with respect to whether their liability is purely derivative. But let's put that aside for a moment. At this stage of the litigation, do you concede that they were in existence at the time of the alleged events of the complaint?
Quite to the contrary, Your Honor.
It's unclear to me what your position was at this point, as I read through the papers. That's why I'm asking.
Well, our position is that there's nothing in the record to suggest or support the notion that they were in existence. And let me tell the court what is in the record, because I think it's important in terms of the pleading out of court issue. There are judicially noticeable documents in the record that show a direct connection between Morton Lapidus and the Cancer Foundation. And specifically, there are these IRS tax documents that show that Mr. Lapidus was the sole director and custodian, of the Cancer Foundation. And second point, Your Honor, there is a 2006 tax form that was filed in June 2007, 1 month prior to the issuance of this complaint, the filing of this lawsuit, in which the Lapidus Brothers Foundation, a foundation controlled by Morton Lapidus, changed its name per this tax record that's in the record before this court, changed its name to the Cancer Foundation. And if the court looks at that, there's actually a handwritten line through the Lapidus Brothers Foundation, and the Cancer Foundation is written above that line. Again, Morton Lapidus, the sole director and custodian of the Cancer Foundation, and that is filed in June 2007, 1 month before the filing of this lawsuit with the Cancer Foundation, now the lead plaintiff in this lawsuit. No tax records discovered, and we said this in our papers below, previous to that filing on behalf of the Cancer Foundation. The tax records that we did find were for the Lapidus Brothers Foundation, same tax identification number as the one used for the Cancer Foundation in 2006. And so, Your Honor, I think at best, very, very troubling circumstances for the creation of the Cancer Foundation based on the record that's before this court.
Going back to the other plaintiffs, Mr. Blood made the point that even if they knew they were injured, they did not know the source of their injury. Could you respond to that?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And again, I just ran through, perhaps too quickly, the sequence of different lawsuits that are alleged and relied upon in the four corners of this complaint.
We've read that as well, yes.
But here is my best attempt to add clarification to that specific question. When the TransColor went bankrupt in August of 1997, there was a public pending lawsuit by Winterland against Carl Campbell alleging that these defendants, Gordon Brothers and their then-president, Warren Federer, had conspired with Campbell to secretly wrest control of Winterland. Now, that may sound familiar because those are the same allegations that are brought in the instant complaint. And, in fact, Judge Lefkoe quoted the entirety of that paragraph I just referenced in her opinion because it's verbatim the same as that 1997 complaint. Now, that's a public lawsuit at the time TransColor was placed into bankruptcy. TransColor goes into bankruptcy. There is then a series of – there are three different lawsuits that are filed either by TransColor or by NCB, through which, in at least two of those lawsuits, the theory that these defendants, the lenders in essence, had caused the harm to TransColor and therefore these note holders, those allegations were brought. All public lawsuits, one of which I've already described, brought on behalf of the note holders. It was their suit. And in June of 2003, the Maryland court again issues a public opinion in the lawsuit brought by these note holders saying that very theory. So I do think there's abundant evidence just in the record based on the four corners of the complaint and those documents and those lawsuits described in the complaint that these note holders discovered or reasonably would have discovered this injury by these appellees based upon those facts and circumstances.
Could we move for a moment to the alternate grounds for affirmance? Can we really reach those grounds? Were the plaintiffs given an adequate opportunity on this motion for summary judgment to respond to them?
There was no, Your Honor, there was no motion for summary judgment below. It was a motion to dismiss based on the statute of limitations grounds. The answer is yes, you can. And the Martinez case that we cite in our paper stands for the proposition that this court can affirm on grounds that were not relied upon by the district court below.
It would have to be evident on the face of the complaint or reasonable inferences.
In our position, Your Honor, is that it is extremely evident. Your Honor asked the question of Mr. Blood in connection with the Cancer Foundation. If you look at the Holmes and the Anza versus Ideal Steel case, the Supreme Court cases that demand proximate cause for RICO civil liability, there are no circumstances, no imaginable circumstances under which the facts as alleged in this complaint would allow for either the 21 note holders or the Cancer Foundation, all of whom are alleged to be remotely injured, would allow them to bring this lawsuit.
How about the issue of whether there really is an adequate allegation of enterprise? Wouldn't it be possible to amend the complaint to show that there was an adequate allegation?
Hard for me to say whether it would be possible, Your Honor, for them to amend the complaint appropriately. I think the way the complaint is drafted, the facts do not lend themselves to an enterprise. And Your Honor made the point about this being a close-ended scheme. I would reiterate that point and emphasize that all of the bad acts alleged are in 1997 over the course of about 3 months. And in a situation of it, the rest is what they call sort of the domino effect of those bad acts. 3 months in 1997, for closed-end schemes, there's no bright-line test that this court has determined in terms of what constitutes a closed-end scheme, what a substantial duration for a pattern is. But there are cases where 9 months wasn't enough. There's one case we cite in our papers where the court determined that even 4 years was not enough in terms of a substantial period of time in a closed-end scheme. This is 3 months in the course of 1997, and I don't think the complaint on the face of it survives on that ground either. With that, if there are no further questions, thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Blood.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll try and make the best of my 90 seconds. We obviously have a very different view of the 1997 Winterland lawsuit against Campbell. The record shows, or the allegations show, that GBCC and Cerberus were the owners of Winterland at that point. That is basically a suit by them against Campbell as the sole defendant, and which we are using as the basis of our equitable estoppel claim. Obviously, opposing counsel does not see it that way, but that's their job. If this court is going to affirm this judgment on other grounds that were not discussed by the district court, that were not pleaded by the defendants, then my advice to my corporate counsel, well, if there is a statute of limitations issue, will be just to raise that issue, because we can sandbag them when we get up to Chicago. Regarding the note holders, NCB did file suit, but I notice that counsel is juxtaposing that to the shareholders filed suit. The shareholders did not file suit. NCB filed suit. Therefore, what the shareholders knew remains an open question. And I again remind the court that this case was dismissed on the grounds that the plaintiffs pled themselves out of court on the statute. And we'd submit that that question should be answered in the negative. If there are no questions, my clients appreciate the hearing.
Thank you. And the case will be taken under advisement. And we'll